Okay. Let's reaccumulate like kidding edema. Okay, I think I'll tell you what intrinsic versus extrinsic means. I'll just give you an example. My son had attention deficit syndrome, and it was hard to get his attention. Okay, so I would grab him, and I'd say, Kate, there's something intrinsically wrong with you. What does that mean? There's something wrong with him. Okay, so when we talk about a hemolytic anemia that's intrinsic, there's something wrong with the red blood cell that's causing it to hemolyze. Like what? No spectrin in a cell membrane? Or what else? No decay accelerating factor in a cell membrane to neutralize complement? What else? No G6PD enzyme in the pentose phosphate shunt? What else? Some abnormal hemoglobin, like hemoglobin S. So there's something intrinsically wrong with the red blood cell that causes it to hemolyze. Okay. Extrinsic means there's nothing wrong with the red blood cell, but it happened to be in the wrong place at the wrong time. It just happened to just smash into that calcified valve. There wasn't anything wrong with it until it hit that stupid valve. Okay? And so that would be extrinsic. It's extrinsic. There was nothing really wrong with the red blood cell. There it was, minding its own business, and IgG and C3b sat on it. And since red blood cells don't have arms, I mean, they can't get it and take it off. Okay? And so there it was, minding its own business, and then these suckers came on it, and then it's just dreading going to the courts of Billroth because it knows what's going to happen to it. It says, I know it's IgG. I know it's C3b. I am a goner. Okay? And so it just goes into that abyss, and it never comes out again. Isn't it sad? I get tears every time I tell this story about the fear that this poor little the red blood cell must go through. I mean, I get that because I'm getting senile and senescent red blood cells. I can just imagine, I can feel for them now, being older myself. Because, you know, when you get older, you get crotchety. You can't really don't have the same flexibility. And so that poor red blood cell, when it's 120 days old, and it gets into the courts of Billroth, by that time it knows the names of all the macrophages. You know, hi Joe, hi Sam, hi Sally, you know. By that time they know it, you know, and then it says, okay, you're clean on the outside and all that. So let's see if you can get to that little 2 micron. Oh, okay, let me there. You You're having a little trouble. Are you having a little trouble, Joe? Kind of, but let me try again. Okay. I can't get out. I can't. Okay, why couldn't it finish the sentence? Who's fabulous a toast? All right. You're starting to catch on. All right. So now let's look at these. Let's deal with something intrinsically wrong with the red blood cell, causing it to hemolyze. There's nothing wrong with the bone marrow, but there's something intrinsically wrong with the red blood cell. So the corrected reticulocyte count is greater than 3%. After we correct for everything, it's still greater than 3%. I have a mnemonic, MAD, M-A-D. If you like damn, you can use that too, but I like MAD better. M-A-D. Membrane defect. Two examples, spherocytosis, paroxysmal nocturnal hemoglobinuria. A, abnormal hemoglobin, sickle cell trait disease. B, deficient enzyme, G6PD deficiency. Those are the most common ones into that group. Okay? So let's just deal with these real quick. Now, do you see anything abnormal about this red blood cell? Look at that one, that one, that one, that one, that one. What don't you see? Central area of pallor. Therefore, what must it be? A serocyte. Okay. How will it be removed? Come on, all that stuff with all that fun and all that extravascularly. Can't get out of the spleen. So how do these patients manifest themselves clinically? Jaundice. What's the main type of bilirubin? Unconjugated. You got it. Okay. Now what's the defect? Spectrin. What's the genetics? Autosomal dominant disease. Okay? Now, because the spleen is the one that's removing these cells, it gets a little bit hypertrophied after a while, so splenomegaly is always seen in these patients over a period of time. Also, would it surprise you that they get gallbladder disease quite commonly? Because they do have a lot more unconjugated bilirubin presented to the liver, so there's a lot more conjugation occurring, and there's a lot more bilirubin in the bile than usual. And whenever you supersaturate anything that's a liquid, you run the risk of forming a stone. You supersaturate urine with calcium, okay, you're going to run the risk of getting a calcium stone. You supersaturate bile with cholesterol, you're going to get cholesterol stone. You supersaturate it with bilirubin, you're going to get a calcium bilirubinate stone. And so these patients commonly have gallbladder disease at a very early age related to gallstone disease, and then obviously they do a CBC, and they see they have a normal acidic anemia with a corrected retic count that's elevated, and then look at this smear, and says, oh my goodness gracious, this patient has congenital serous cytosis. So what's the diagnostic test for this? Osmotic fragility. They put these poor little red blood cells at a wall-to-wall membrane. Remember, they have two little membrane, and they put them into these test tubes with different tonicities of saline, and they don't last normal saline. I mean, you put them into that, and they go poop, okay, because as soon as they get any sodium in them, they have no room for anything else, they just pop. So that increased osmotic fragility. Treatment, splenectomy. Got to remove the thing that's removing them. Now that's not going to make this become a biconcave disc, but at least there's nothing around that can knock it off anymore. That's it. That's congenital serous cytosis. I have no slide for paroxysmal nocturnal hemoglobinuria, usually not on exams, but just in case. It's a defect in decay accelerating factors. See, while you were sleeping last night, we had a little bit of mild respiratory acidosis. We don't breathe as fast when we sleep as we do now. Of course, if you have obstructive sleep apnea, you really have a problem with respiratory acidosis. But anyway, when you have acidosis, that predisposes to complement coming and sitting on your cells that are circulating in your bloodstream. That's all of them. RBCs, platelets, white blood cells, all will have complement sitting on it. Now, so how come we don't get complement destruction of our RBCs, neutrophils, and platelets every night when we sleep? Answer, in our membranes, we have a decay accelerating factor, which causes increased degradation of that complement so it doesn't have an opportunity of drilling a hole in our membrane. And so we don't wake up in the morning with hemoglobinuria and neutropenia and thrombocytopenia, thank God. Okay. So if you are missing a decay accelerating factor, then complement is activated. It goes from 1 to 9. And if that's true, then what type of hemolysis is it? That intravascular or extravascular? Intravascular. It's called paroxysmal, just think of the term, nocturnal hemoglobinuria. It's occurring at night, then you wake up in the morning, and what do you pee out? Hemoglobin. Okay? And so when they do a CBC on you, you not only have a severe anemia, which is normal acidic, okay, you also have neutropenia and thrombocytopenia, have pancytopenia with disease. It's a very bad disease, paroxysmal nocturnal hemoglobinuria. Now, and you all should know what this is. That's a sickle cell. Okay, if it looks like a sickle, smells like a sickle, say tastes like a sickle, it's a sickle. Okay. Now, I'm going to ask you, first of all, an easy question. Could this be sickle cell trait? No. In sickle cell trait, you have no anemia, no sickle cells in the peripheral blood. Now, you could have sickle cells in a certain part of your body. Where would that be? The renal medulla and the peritubular capillaries, but you ain't going to see them in your peripheral blood. All right. Now, the reason why that is, in sickle cell anemia, sickle cell disease, the amount of sickle hemoglobin in your red blood cell determines whether it sickles or not. The magic number is 60%. If you have 60% or more hemoglobin S in your red blood cell, then it can spontaneously sickle. Okay, so that's the key thing. Another thing that determines whether it can sickle is the oxygen tension in your blood. If you lower the oxygen tension, let's say hypoxemia or something, that can induce sickling. Okay, so that can do it also as well. All right. Now, remember, it's an autosomal recessive disease. So you've had a little bit of genetics? I guess that's going to be with Reichenbach on Monday. Yeah, or Saturday. Okay, he's good, by the way. He's really good. Nice, slow, methodical, good slides. Okay. So what is omal recessive? Now, what does that mean? It means that both parents have to have the abnormal gene on their chromosome. Usually they're both traits. So you can't have a person that's normal and a person with trait or a person with disease. You have to have the other partner has to also have the abnormal gene, as you'll find out. So it's usually two traits, and they either know or they don't know that they have the disease. Okay, I mean the trait. And so you have about 25% chance of a totally normal child. You got a 50% chance of a sickle cell trait, and you got a 25% chance of sickle cell disease when you have an autosomal recessive inheritance pattern. We have two asymptomatic carriers together. Same thing is true for cystic fibrosis. Asymptomatic carrier male, asymptomatic carrier female, 25% chance no cystic fibrosis, 50% chance an asymptomatic carrier of it, a 25% chance for having the actual cystic fibrosis, because you have to be homozygous for that abnormal gene. Okay, now that's going into genetics. All right. Now, let's talk about some of the three characteristics of sickle cell trait and sickle cell disease. Remember we said in a sickle cell trait, if you have a black individual that is totally normal on physical exam, has a totally normal CBC, but has microscopic hematuria in their urine, what's your first step in a workup? Sickle cell screen. Always get a sickle cell screen, because microscopic hematuria is always abnormal. You always have to work that up. But in a person that's a black individual where sickle cell is in 1 in 8 people, I mean, that's the first thing that you're going to be thinking about. Not a renal stone and not IgA glomerulonephritis. You're going to be thinking sickle cell trait more commonly. Okay? So that'd be your first step in working the patient up. Do a sickle cell screen. And if they have sickle cell trait, it'll be positive. Okay? That's all I want to say about trait. Let's just talk about disease. When we talk about sickle cell disease, there are two things that are happening. One, you have a hemolytic anemia, so you have an anemia to deal with, usually extravascular. Second, you have occlusion of small blood vessels by these sickle cells. Can you imagine these cells just piling up in a little capillary? I mean, it's like a log jam in Oregon or Washington, you know, out there, when their loggers put the logs in the water, okay, and all of a sudden there's a jam, okay? Well, that's kind of like what sickle cell vaso-occlusive crises are like. You got all these sickle cells, and all of a sudden there's a jam. So that means there's going to be ischemia to whatever tissue it's supplying. And that produces pain. Ischemia always produces pain. And so they're usually painful crises. And it can be in any organ in the body, from lungs to liver to spleen to bone marrow. Unfortunately, when it begins in little children, it begins in the hands and feet with a so-called dactylitis. Okay? Those are examples of vaso-occlusive diseases. And so the two things we worry about with sickle cell disease are, one, the anemia, which can be oftentimes very severe and commonly requires a transfusion requirement, and secondly, vaso-occlusive disease, where the sickle cells are just blocking the circulation. And you can see over time that that's going to produce damage to those individual organs. Kidneys are going to get screwed up. The spleen is going to get eventually auto-infarcted, so it's about the size of your thumb. But understand this. You don't have autosplenectomy until probably the first decade. I mean, maybe not first decade. I always screw that up. Maybe somewhere 18, 19, 20 is when the spleen's about the size of your thumb. First 10 years of your life, you have splenomegaly. Splenomegaly, because you have all those trapped cells in there, the red blood cells. So don't think that the spleen is completely auto-infarcted and has almost disappeared, you know, right off the bat. No, it takes at least 18, 20 years before that dude is totally annihilated. But I'll tell you this, after 2 years, it's totally non-functional. So you might have a big spleen, but the sucker ain't working because it's just been so damaged. So how are you going to know when that happens? How are you going to know when the patient has a non-functioning spleen by 2 years of age? Let me show you the reason. I'll go back to that in a second. That's how you know. You're saying to yourself, is that just a speck on the slide? No. That is a piece of nucleus. That shouldn't be there. It's called a Howell Jolly Body. That's how you know the spleen ain't working in that little dude. Because if the spleen was working, A fixed macrophage in the cords of Billroth would have pitted that out and removed it. When you start seeing these come up, there's only one of them here, in the peripheral blood, you know the spleen ain't working. And fortunately, actually, it's by 2 years of age when this happens. Why is that fortunate? Because that's the time you can get Pneumovax. You see, when your spleen is non-functional, there is one infection that you are going to get guaranteed, and that's strep pneumoniae sepsis. You are guaranteed. That's the most common cause of death in a little dude with sickle cell disease, is strep pneumoniae sepsis. And so they try to cover them with antibiotics, and they try to cover them, of course, with Pneumovax, but you can't give Pneumovax until 2 years of age. And that's just about the time when the spleen ain't working and you start seeing how old Jolly Body's present. So that's a concept that I want to get across, and they like how old Jolly Body's on examinations. I can't find the slide that they have, but I know that there's a slide. Just take this cell right over here with the how old Jolly Body, okay, put it together with this slide. So let's say that cell was right over here. You have a how old Jolly Body and this over here. I mean, that's one of the slides they have on the boards. So we'll have the sickle cells, and we'll have another red blood cell with a how old Jolly Body in it. Okay, and they'll ask you about the what's going on in the spleen. The answer is it's totally dysfunctional. It doesn't work at all. Because if it was, the macrophages would have removed the Howell Jolly Body. Comprende? Got that one so far? Now, in terms of boards, for part one, they don't spend a whole lot of time on therapy. They don't spend a lot of time on things like preoptism, some of those kinds of things. They spend most of their time on when do they first get their first sickle cell crisis. When does a poor little dude develop this? Where the poor hands are all swollen up, they're so painful, the feet the same way. This is called dactylitis. Now, when is this going to occur? Right at birth in a sickle cell? No. And the reason for that is that hemoglobin F inhibits sickling. And as you know, newborns have 70, 80% of their red blood cells normally have hemoglobin F. Okay? Now, in a sickle cell disease, it'd be something like this. 60 to 70% of their RBCs has hemoglobin F, and the other ones have hemoglobin S. Okay? But there's enough hemoglobin F to prevent sickling. It inhibits it. But then as those red blood cells get broken down and replaced, the hemoglobin F decreases and the hemoglobin S increases. By 6 to 9 months of age, it's a high enough concentration to induce sickling and their first vaso-occlusive crisis, which produces this, dactylitis. This exact picture was on board. Now, here's something really, really sad. Remember that slide I showed you of the hand with the epiphyses? That was his hand. So this was a kid with sickle cell disease with dactylitis, and they x-rayed the hand. And the reason why those bones look all washed out, they were all white, they were infarcted. Because what's happening is there's bone infarctions occurring from all the sickling in the bone marrow, and it's infarcting the bone. Okay, and that's why it hurts so much. And then they x-ray this poor kid's hand, and lo and behold, the poor little kid had lead poisoning too. Had a double whammy, sickle cell disease and lead poisoning. Isn't that horrible? And it was this poor little kid that they took this picture on. Okay, so this is important. Dactylitis usually doesn't come until 6 to 9 months. Why? Because hemoglobin F inhibits sickling. That's the reason. Okay. The last important one that they usually ask on examination is the osteomyelitis. Okay. These patients are very, very susceptible to osteomyelitis, and not the usual Staph aureus cause, but usually salmonella. One reason for that is the dysfunctional spleen. You see, a salmonella is destroyed by macrophages. It's not destroyed by other mechanisms. And because the spleen is totally dysfunctional, it can't filter out salmonella. And so that's why it is actually the more common cause of osteomyelitis. Actually, in Cecil's, in their little table, it's about 75% of the time it's salmonella species causing osteomyelitis and sickle cell disease. And then it goes, the next most common one is Staph aureus, and it keeps on going down. But salmonella is numero uno. That's commonly asked on exams. Okay? Let's see, anything else? Yes. What did our little friend with the English accent tell you about a drug that can be used in decreasing the incidence of vaso-occlusive crises? Hydroxyurea, and how did that work? It increased hemoglobin F synthesis. Of course, though, you have to take a chemotherapy agent, so that's not too cool. Okay? That's about it. There's a lot more on sickle cell disease, guys, but for part one, those are the key things that are tested. I did put the other things in the notes because I like my notes to also be used for part two, so I kept the other things in there too, but they're not the ones that they usually ask on part one. Remember, this is for second-year medical students who don't have any clinical experience yet, so they don't get into things like acute chest syndrome, they don't get into things like aplastic crises, they don't get into that stuff. That's more part two-ish. Part one's the kind of stuff that we just discussed. What's that called? How old jolly body, all right. All right, now we're down to the D of the intrinsic defects, and this, of course, is G6PD deficiency. What's the genetics? Sex-linked recessive. Anybody know, you all know that most enzyme deficiency conditions are recessive, isn't that correct? So when you're talking about inborn errors of metabolism, like PKU, albinism, homocystinuria, the majority of those are autosomal recessive. Isn't that correct? Okay. So that means you got a 1 in 4 chance with two asymptomatic carriers having a kid with the disease. Correct? But remember, sex-linked recessive is recessive too. Okay? Could you name for me, please, two sex-linked recessive enzyme deficiencies? Well, this one's one, G6PD, and the other one involves purine metabolism, Lesch-Nihon syndrome. There you go. And I found that Dr. Hansen, I know, will cover that beautifully. Lesch-Nihon syndrome is on every single exam. Why? Because it's a classic correlation of a disease with a biochemical pathway, purine metabolism, big time. Remember, those are the kids that are mentally retarded, self-mutilation, the whole bit. That increase in uric acid, and HGPRT is deficient. Don't ask me what that stands for. It's something big. It's something very, very big and long. Okay, so we don't have to worry about that one. Just like PPRP, you know, and that thing. Forget it, okay? It's a very, very long name, which I don't know. But you'd be able to figure it out if you saw it, because it'd be this long across the computer screen. And you'd be able to figure out there's a P, there's an R, okay, this is what it is, okay. I know the first H stands for hypoxanthine and the rest, screw it, I don't know. Now this is very important, guys, and it'd be a good review for you here. Remember that there's a couple things you can do with glucose-6-phosphate, one of which is to make glutathione and also to make ribose, 5-carbon sugars for making DNA, isn't that correct, from this pathway. Also, you can make glycogen from glucose-6-phosphate, as you'll learn in biochemistry. This can be converted to glucose-1, UDP glucose, and glycogen. Or glucose-6-phosphate can be the substrate used for making glutathione and other substrates. Here's the key thing. Here's your enzyme. That you're going to have. You're going to be able to make NADPH, which is the major factor for anabolic types of biochemical reactions in our body, like steroid synthesis and stuff like that. Okay, then we go to the next part of it. NADPH will reduce oxidized glutathione to our little friend glutathione. And what's its job? Is to neutralize peroxide into water. Anybody remember what the name of the vitamin was that catalyzed this reaction here? Riboflavin. Anybody remember the enzyme that helped glutathione neutralize peroxide? Glutathione peroxidase. And what was the trace metal that was involved in it? Selenium. That's very good. Okay. Every living cell, guys, makes peroxide as an end product. That's just a normal end product of normal metabolism. And that's why every living cell has to have some way of handling it. Now, you already know about the enzyme catalase. Catalase is present in all cells except RBCs, and that can neutralize peroxide. It's stored in peroxisomes. Okay, the other way that you can neutralize peroxide is with glutathione. That's the only thing available to red blood cells. They don't have catalase. And so if you're deficient in this enzyme, then you've got a problem, because as this increases, why would that increase to a point where you'd start hemolyzing? Well, if you had an infection, it would be more of it. Or if you took a certain drug that was an oxidizing drug, like a sulfa drug or a nitro drug, you're going to get a lot more peroxide around. Not good. Because peroxide is not going to be able to be neutralized if you're deficient in that enzyme. And so what's going to happen is peroxide is going to really do a job on your hemoglobin. It's going to cause it to clump up, and we call those Heinz bodies. It's just a bunch of hemoglobin all clumped up together. And it's going to do a job on your red blood cell membrane. In fact, that's the real problem, because it damages the red blood cell membrane so much that the primary mechanism for destruction is intravascular. There's a little bit of element of extravascular, but it's mainly intravascular hemolysis, precipitated by infections and or precipitated by drugs. Now, let me tell you the two drugs that have been on, that they're using alternately on examinations. The one that used to be the most famous one was Permequin. And so it was always the medical missionary question, okay? And then they got malaria, and then they received a drug, they usually don't say Permequin, and developed 2 or 3 days later hemoglobinuria, chills, and a hemolytic anemia, okay? And that was the Permequin-induced hemolysis. Lately, they've been using Dapsone. Dapsone is the one they're using. Of course, that's used in treating leprosy. So they're going to have to find some way to worm in Dapsone into the question in terms of treating. In fact, I looked that up. Every person that's in a leprosarium, before they put them on Dapsone, they do a screen for G6PD because of the high incidence of producing hemolysis. So that's just a normal screening test they do on patients with leprosy that they're going to put on Dapsone because it's so high. Who do we see this disease in? Pretty much the same ones that we see with beta thal. That'll be the black population, the Greek, and the Italian population. So beta thal and G6PD deficiency are two things that are kind of in the same groups of people. Let me show you what the Heinz bodies look like. Now this is what a smear looks like in someone that's actively hemolyzing their red blood cells. And you can see they look kind of ratty. Okay, but you know, you don't see anything bad, but you do a special stain on them, and this is what these cells really like. Look at that. Look at all these little clumps, blue clumps over there, all over the place. Notice some of them are right on the membrane. These are called Heinz bodies. Okay, now take this one over here. Okay, when this goes into the cords of Billeroth, the macrophage will see that big thing, and it'll take a big bite out of that membrane. Okay, and sometimes it's just a small bite, and so that cell can get out into the peripheral blood with just a piece of its membrane missing. Okay, like something took a bite out of it, hence the term bite cells. Okay, bite cells. Take, for example, this red blood cell. I can see just a little bit of membrane here, but just make believe it wasn't there, and he had this cell that looks like a big bite was taken out of it. It's a very, very characteristic finding in the peripheral blood in G6PD deficiency of bite cells. So you have to do special stains to identify these Heinz bodies. That's why another name for this is called Heinz body anemia. In patients that are Greeks or Italians that have the very severe form of G6PD deficiency, they can just eat fava beans and precipitate a hemolytic episode. Okay? And that's fava beans like in salads and stuff like that. But sometimes they call it favism. And that can precipitate it as well. Last thing on G6PD deficiency is diagnosis. Okay. When you have an acute hemolytic episode, guys, the last thing in the world that you want to do to make the diagnosis is to get an enzyme assay. Why? Because the only cells that are hemolyzed are the ones that are missing the enzymes. The one that have the enzymes or have G6PD are still going to be there. So you'd have a normal assay. So you never use enzyme assays in an active hemolysis. You do the stain, special stain to identify the Heinz bodies. When the hemolytic episode is over, that's when you confirm your diagnosis with a G6PD assay. On occasion, that question has been asked. And that's pretty much it for this. Okay? Almost guaranteed that you're going to get a G6PD deficiency question. I would literally say that probably 95% of you in this room will have a question on it. That's going to either be Dapsone related or Permequin related. Okay, autoimmune hemolytic anemias. You had immunology, so you know that warm-reacting antibodies are IgG, and cold-reacting antibodies are IgM. Okay. Would it make sense to you that the most common autoimmune hemolytic anemia is warm, and the most common cause of it is lupus? Would that surprise you? Shouldn't, because it's a concept. When you have autoimmune disease in your family, guys, you have certain HLA types which predispose you to that autoimmune disease. So therefore, you should not be surprised if you have one autoimmune disease, you're likely to have another. Okay, so patients with lupus not only have lupus, but they commonly have autoimmune hemolytic anemia, autoimmune thrombocytopenia, autoimmune neutropenia, autoimmune lymphopenia. Patients, let's say, with Hashimoto's thyroiditis, the most common cause of hypothyroidism, very commonly have other endocrine diseases. Like what? Pernicious anemia, vitiligo, autoimmune destruction of melanocytes. So if you have one autoimmune disease, it's very likely that if you have some hematologic problem with something else, it's also autoimmune related because of the HLA relationship. In fact, one board question is, if you have a family that has an autoimmune disease, what would be the single best screening test to use? That's the question. The answer is HLA. Okay, find out if they have the HLA type that's specific for lupus or Hashimoto's. They have specific HLA relationships. That would be the best screen. That would be the best screen. Because not all autoimmune diseases have positive serum ANAs, anti-nuclear antibodies. Okay, so that would be HLA would be the best way of really testing everybody to see if they're predisposed to something. Okay, what I've decided to do on this is to use the drug-induced autoimmune hemolytic anemias, which are always asked on boards. I don't know if Trevor did this with you, but it's very important that you get this down. So lupus would be the most common cause of autoimmune hemolytic anemia, and it's going to have IgG and C3b on the surface of the red blood cell. So how is that going to be removed, that cell? Macrophages. So that's an extravascular hemolytic anemia. Now, how are we going to know that there are IgG or C3b antibodies on the surface of those RB cells? What test? Coombs test. Direct Coombs or indirect Coombs? Direct Coombs. Direct Coombs detect directly the presence of IgG and or C3b on the surface of red blood cells. Indirect Coombs is what you women get when you're pregnant and you come into your first visit. They do an antibody screen on you to see if you have anti-D, anti-this, anti-that. So when you're looking for an antibody in serum, not on a red blood cell, in the serum, that's an indirect Coombs. So another name for it is an antibody screen. Direct Coombs is looking for IgG and or C3b on the surface of red blood cells. You can't do a direct Coombs on platelets. You can't do a direct Coombs on neutrophils, only on red blood cells. So the test of choice if you suspect an autoimmune hemolytic anemia is a Coombs test. Don't ever forget that. All right. Now, there's three types of drug-induced hemolytic anemia. That's the second most common cause of autoimmune hemolytic anemia. The most common is lupus. The first one's penicillin. Mechanism of penicillin, where is it? Let's see. Oh, forget this thing. I don't need it. The mechanism of penicillin is this. Penicillin, when anyone takes it, the BPO group, that's called the penicilloyl group, of penicillin attaches to your red blood cells. And so if you're on penicillin right now, you have a little piece of penicillin attached to your red blood cell. Now, you better pray that you don't develop an IgG antibody against that. Because if you did, then an IgG antibody would attach to that BPO group on the surface of your red blood cell. And when that sucker goes to the spleen, it's going to get removed extravascularly. So what type of hypersensitivity is that, please? Two. Here's a question. I was on boards. Person's on penicillin, develops a rash. What type of hypersensitivity? One. Person's on penicillin, develops a hemolytic anemia. What type of hypersensitivity? Two. That was a board question. Let's do the next one. Methyldopa. Another name, Aldomet. Use? Antihypertensive. One of those drugs that can be given to a pregnant woman with hypertension. Remember, it's only basically two. And that's hydralazine and methyldopa that can be used in pregnant women. And both have their complications. Methyldopa, as you know, can produce a hemolytic anemia. Hydralazine can precipitate drug-induced lupus. it's second to procainamide as a cause of drug-induced lupus. Okay. How does methyl-DOPA work? Oh, it's different than penicillin. That's why they love this question. Methyl-DOPA screws around with your Rh antigens on the surface of your red blood cell and alters them. It screws them up so bad that you make antibodies against your own Rh antigens, IgG antibodies. So the drug is not sitting on your membrane. It just screws around with your Rh antigens, screws them up so bad that you form IgG antibodies against D and E and all of them. Okay? And those IgG antibodies attach to that red blood cell. Who removes it? Macrophages. What type of hypersensitivity? 2. So penicillin and methyl-DOPA are both 2. The third one is the innocent bystander. That's immune complex. Classic drugs, quinidine is probably the classic drug for this one. What is happening is quinidine is acting as the hapten, and an IgM, not G, antibody attaches to the drug, forms an immune complex. So we have the drug and IgM attached together and circulating in your bloodstream. Now you already know that this is a different hypersensitivity. This is what? 3. And you even also know how it's going to die, because I said IgM. So what's IgM going to do when that immune complex sees a red blood cell down there and says, that's the one we want to destroy? And it comes down and sits on the top. What is IgM going to activate? The classical pathway, and you're going to stop at C3, you're going to go to C9. C9, so what type of hemolysis is that? Intravascular. So if that's true, what protein would be decreased? Haptoglobin. And what would be present in the urine? Hemoglobin. Very good. Guys, that it's so important. I can't. Now you're going to get clearly one of those three or more than those, a question related to how they produce a hemolytic anemia. Guaranteed. Okay. Guaranteed. All right. This is how you guys are beginning to look right now. Okay. Some of you probably identify with some of these cells right now. Let's see. How many of you feel like a fish? Nobody. Okay. How many of you feel like, a tadpole? Nobody. Okay. How many of you feel like a German helmet? You know, you're on your motorcycle, Harley, and you got this little German helmet. Nobody. How many of you feel this totally nondescript and a piece of crap? Everybody. Okay. Now, what is this type of hemolytic anemia called? It's called a microangiopathic hemolytic anemia. And what are these RBCs that are all fragmented called? Schistocytes. Schisto means split. Not. I'm saying schistocytes. Did you hear that? Schistocytes, not other sites. Okay. Schistocytes. Okay. And they produce these all weirdo forms. Okay, it's kind of looking at clouds and saying, that looks like this. Well, you can identify with these things. Now, these have hit something. And it's sitting right next to it on the left. This is what it hit. And this happens to be the most common cause of this hemolytic anemia. And that is aortic stenosis. And these cells hit, when they were normal, they had hit this thing. They got totally destroyed like this. And so it's an intravascular hemolysis. The hemoglobin concentration goes down. Haptoglobin is lost in the urine. Now, guys, let me tell you something. Is this a chronic intravascular hemolysis? Sure. Are you going to be losing a lot of hemoglobin in your urine? Yes. What does hemoglobin have attached to it? Iron. So what's another potential anemia you can get in these patients, guys? Iron deficiency anemia. Man, they like this question. It's this long on boards. Because they go through the murmur characteristics. They don't say aortic stenosis. They're going to describe the systolic ejection murmur, right second intercostal space, radiating into the carotids, has an S4 heart sound, increases in intensity on expiration, has a prominent PMI, and then they're going to say, and they have the following CBC findings, and that's this long, and you see, low MCV. Ooh. And then they say that fragmented, don't say schistocytes, it gives it away, and fragmented RBC is present. And they said, what happened? And the answer is that it's a microangiopathic hemolytic anemia related to aortic stenosis. I can't tell you how many times it's been on an exam. That's the one they make this long. They get lots of physical diagnosis in that. So these are called schistocytes. Okay. Other causes, DIC. Disseminated intravascular coagulation can do this. You know, most of us think that RBCs are pretty strong, right? Mm-mm. They are very, very fragile. And so just little fibrin strands and disseminated intravascular coagulation split them right in half. So you commonly see them in that. And when we talk about thrombotic thrombocytopenic purpura, we talk about hemolytic uremic syndrome, probably tomorrow. Okay, we're going to see schistocytes are involved in that too. Because if you have these little platelet plugs scattered throughout all the small blood vessels in your body, you're going to have a big time problem in banging into these things. And you're going to have schistocytes and a microangiopathic hemolytic anemia, big time. Those of you that are long distance runners, this is runner's anemia. Okay? Because if you're doing long distance, you smash the living crap out of your red blood cells when you hit the pavement. And very commonly, because I've ran three marathons, very commonly you take a pee after you finish the marathon and you see hemoglobin in it. That happened to my buddy that ran the Boston Marathon. How do I know? Because I was standing next to him when he peed. And all guys always check what the other guy's doing. So I looked over there and said, Bob, check out the urine. And he had hemoglobinuria. He's the same idiot that didn't listen to the instructions at the beginning of the race. Because you're on this road that's even smaller than this is wide, and it goes back way back there. And you're stuck in there like this. And he said, make sure before you get in line to go to the bathroom. Because it's going to take a long time before you even reach the starting line. Bob didn't listen. He did not listen. Okay. So we heard the gun go off. This is the time that Bill Rogers ran. As you can see, that was long ago. But they didn't put us in the front line. We were idiots. So we're in the back. And so I don't think I moved for 4 minutes. Okay, now you're going like this. And they said, if your shoe comes off, don't pick it up. A couple people have been trampled to death. And so we're walking about like this when we hit the starting line. And then Bob's right next to me says, I got to take a crap. I says, what are you telling me that for? What do you want me to do about it? He says, I really got to take a crap. I said, didn't they tell you to go to the bathroom? But I didn't think it was going to be this bad. What am I going to do? And what do you think Bob did? He was a pathologist. They're very, very disgusting people. There's this poor sucker that's watering his sapling in front of his house. Okay. This is the true story. He ran over to this. He grabbed the sapling. He pulled his pants down and crapped right there. He took the guy's hose, who's staring at him incredulously, cleaned his butt off, picked the thing up, and finished the race. That was disgusting. And that's what he did. That's what he did. It was disgusting. He actually did that. This is a true story. So he deserved to get hemoglobinuria. He deserved it. That was terrible. I said, Bob, what did you do that for? He says, like, well, you got a crap. Okay. Oh, God. What an idiot. This is a freebie, guys, because you've already had micro. Who can tell me what this is? Malaria. It's malaria. Which type? Falciparum. Why? Well, first of all, there's only ring form. Secondly, you have superinfection. You got more than one ring form in there. 1, 2, 3. What's the other form that could potentially be in the in falciparum malaria? The comma-shaped things. Okay, so the gametocyte and the ring form is the only thing out there. These produce a hemolytic anemia. Remember, the hemolytic anemia correlates, and the fever of malaria correlates when the cells rupture. That's when you get the fever spikes. Anybody remember the fever pattern? Quotidian. Okay, which means it can come up anytime versus the other types. Okay, so I thought I'd just throw calcium. This exact picture's been on many, many, many boards. Okay, where are we? Here, okay. But we're 5 minutes away from a break. Warm white blood cells. That's pretty good. That's not too bad. And so I kind of have a kind of a conglomeration of different things up over here. So let's talk about some of the benign changes that occur with different types of cells. Now, we already know about neutrophils. We already know that when we have acute inflammation, especially related to things like appendicitis, etc., we get absolute neutrophilic leukocytosis, right? Left shift, poxygranulation. Okay, so we know that. But I want to introduce you to two more terms. Leukemoid reaction. Okay, what does oid mean? Sounds like but isn't. So what are they saying? They're saying it looks like it's leukemia, but it isn't. It's something that's benign. Usually a leukemoid reaction can involve any of the cell lines. You can get leukemoid reactions in lymphocytes, neutrophils, eosinophils, and other cells. Okay? But let's talk about neutrophils. What causes leukemoid reactions? Well, usually serious infections, things like TB, sepsis, and you get like greater than 30,000, greater than 50,000 cells in the peripheral blood. That's called leukemoid reaction. They like that. Okay, so it's a benign, or let's say an over-exaggerated response to an infection. Let me tell you who really gets these things. Kids do. When kids get any kind of infection, otitis media, don't be surprised to see if you happen to get a CBC, a 30,000 neutrophil count. Do not be surprised. Okay, now if it was an adult with otitis media, maybe they had 12,000. Kid, 30,000, because they get an exaggerated response. And there's a certain type of infection that scares the crap out of pediatricians, okay? Unfortunately, not pathologists, but pediatricians. It scares them. And that is pertussis. If you have whooping cough, you get a rip-roaring lymphocytosis, big time. 60,000, not uncommon. So what do you think pediatricians go berserk? Why did they go so berserk with a 60,000 count, all of which are lymphocytes? What do you think they're worried about? Acute lymphoblastic leukemia. Except the problem is they don't have anemia and they don't have thrombocytopenia. But they literally come in pale, saying, could you please look at this peripheral blood? I got this kid, he's coughing and all that stuff, and I think it's pertussis, but I've got 60,000 count. I said, I've already seen it. Mature lymphocytes are totally mature, they're not atypical, there's no anemia, no thrombocytopenia, it's pertussis. Okay, so that's called a leukemoid reaction. Okay? So that's what I wanted to introduce you to, and that's about it on that. Okay, here's lots of lymphocytes. You can see these things. Remember, kids often react with viral infections, they get a lymphocytosis, or with pertussis, they get a lymphocytosis. This is an atypical lymphocyte. I don't really like that term. Not that it matters, who cares whether I like it or not. But basically, it's a lymphocyte that's doing what it's supposed to do when presented with antigen. It's responding to the antigen by dividing and getting bigger. So it's basically an antigenically stimulated lymphocyte. Now, I said atypical lymphocyte. What was the absolute first thing that went through your mind? Mono. Okay, but can I expand your knowledge a little bit? Okay, mono isn't the only thing that can produce these large, beautiful, bluish staining cells. Cytomegalovirus can do it. Toxoplasmosis can do it. Any cause of hepatitis can do it. Viral hepatitis. And there's a drug that can do it that we already talked about once. And this drug produced a macrocytic anemia. Could you tell me what that drug was? It blocked intestinal conjugates. Phenytoin. Phenytoin produces an atypical lymphocytosis. So could you please expand your mind on atypical lymphocytes? Turns out that this is a patient that had infectious mono. What's that due to? Epstein-Barr virus. It's usually transmitted by kissing. Okay, because the virus holds up in your salivary glands. And it infects what cell? Don't say T, say B. And what's the receptor? CD21. Very good. Okay. Now you all know about mono. You know that you get a viremia, generalized painful lymphadenopathy. You get an exudative tonsillitis very commonly. And most of the time it isn't group A strep. Most of the time it's the virus itself that's producing that tonsillitis. They all have hepatitis but never have jaundice. I've never seen jaundice in mononucleosis. Never. Never seen it. And the transaminases are off the map. I've seen 2,000, 3,000 SGPTs and, you know, and increased SGOTs. They never goes into chronic disease, but they always have a hepatitis. Of course, they have a spleen that has a tendency for wanting to rupture. Usually not spontaneously, like they say. Usually some kid that's in high school that's got mono, you tell them, don't wrestle anymore, don't play football, and they don't listen to you, they get tackled, and they rupture their spleen, and they die, and they go after you and try to sue you. When you told them, don't do that. Okay, so you got to be very careful. especially with high school kids that are in sports when they have mono. You write it down on your stuff there, and you get that parent in there and say, do not let them for 6 to 8 weeks do any contact sports because their spleen can rupture. Do we understand each other? Okay? And then usually the parents will get that and keep the kid from doing it and you from getting a lawsuit. Okay? So let's break for 10.